Good evening and welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Sarah Holliday, Library Events Coordinator, and I'm mostly standing here to remind you that in the original era of tall ships, there were no cell phones, so let us please turn ours off in observance of this event. Also in observance of this event, I just want to brag to you, I'm wearing my bosun's whistle, which does in fact whistle, but no matter how much you beg and plead, I am not going to blow it. It is much too loud. pretty though, isn't it? So I am not going to tell you any more than that, and that I appreciate your being here. I'm going to hand the floor over to Robert Ferraro, who is going to give a little more substantial introduction to tonight's presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. Yeah, you're all very lucky because my wife insisted I use the short introduction as opposed to the long one I wrote. I was very fortunate to be with Peter and Norma a couple of years ago. When the South Street Seaport Museum first got its legs. At any rate, I'm delighted to help introduce Peter and Norma to this happy institution, which has been for so long central to the intellectual and creative life of the city. In their book, they tell the story of how they created the South Street Seaport in a one-time neglected and raffish corner of New York, and how the seaport and its ships became and remain an iconic symbol of the city. Even those now publicly warring over the future of South Street agree that the seaport is indeed a seminal part of our history and of the downtown economy and needs to survive as a living testament to the city's maritime past. But it is the character of that renewed seaport that is at issue and which makes this story so relevant today. The book tells of how Peter and Norma started with a dream many believed quixotic, to recreate in the heart of our city the old seaport of New York. That was our motto. And then the story goes on to how they developed the tools to make that dream reality. That is how they were eventually able to forge a consensus among the corporate, real estate, political, and popular leadership of the city. As the book's subtitle says, how New Yorkers came together to save the city's sailing ship waterfront. Very much an organization of and by the people. South Street, once known around the world as the Street of Ships, was in the 60s both a neglected corner and supremely precious. From the beginning, the seaport plan was to take advantage of that precious location. It was not meant to be a fusty museum of dusty scrimshaw, but a vibrant neighborhood. Peter and Norma saw the need for the South Street seaport to honor the commercial roots of the district by bringing economic life back to the area. They were talking about an economic as well as cultural revitalization, and as Peter will tell you, it actually worked once. At the heart of the South Street story is the old port and the schooners and tall ships that brought it to life. With those ships came bustling commerce, new ideas, new people, and new vitality. That was the true cargo those ships carried from all over the world, and which helped create the mercantile soul of this city, this metropolis, and indeed the nation. That story, that history needs to be told, and it is told best through the muscular presence of the ships themselves. Finally, the South Street Seaport experience can be seen as a blueprint for urban activists hoping to create progress in the face of seemingly intractable opposition. Rally the public, rouse the press, pressure the politicians, and mobilize the commercial and intellectual leadership of the city to your cause. That's what they did, exactly. If you love New York, you'll love their story. Peter and Norma.
Yeah, well, it's always difficult to say where something begins because there are many routes, particularly in a project like this, where he says, where our friend Bob says that we did this, we did that. Well, being Norma and me, well, a lot of other people, thousands of other people made it work, and one always has to be conscious of that. Anyway, our starting point was a Sunday afternoon walk, a very dangerous practice in New York. You never know what you're going to end up in. And in this case, we ran across a vessel that I was just explaining to the kids whom we had with us. We'd gone down to the fish market. It was, there had been a gale, bad weather. We thought there'd be some fishing boats taking shelter from the blow. And sure enough, there were. And I said, well, when I was a kid, I came down here in the 1930s, and they still had old schooners that had been refitted with engines. And then they began building motorboats. And so we don't have any of those glorious old schooners left. And then I looked. It may have been Norma who, again, played a vital role by saying, Peter, are you sure about that? In these stubby little masts and dirty smoke sacks all around, there was this pure schooner hull. And on her foremast, she had a lovely name, Lady of Good Voyage. And I'm easily seduced by names like that. You really go and do anything to rescue a lady, a good voyage. And but anyway, she had recognizably topmast hoops on the foremast. That meant she'd been built to travel fast under sail, not under power. And she was indeed a schooner. And we also had Norma, well, I've always described this as the period when we're, what is it about schooners? They're a delightfully antique rig, very American, utterly different from British or French schooners. And we had finally put our pennies together. Yeah, but
she's on the screen now.
On the screen.
Yeah, and she was. She had a nice antique rig about her, and we loved her dearly. So we were certainly entranced by schooners, and seeing this one at the Fish Market Piers was a delight. What else? Her name was Athena. Now she had been, when we bought her, her name was
Heart's Desire.
And she had been a boat in Maine that was rented out for people to sail in Maine. Heart's Desire was a little more than I wasn't wild about the name. Peter, I think you would have stuck with it, because Peter doesn't believe in changing a ship's name. But I just thought, I don't think I can handle Heart's Desire. Let's call her Athena. I'd just been immersed in things Greek for a long time, and so I picked that
also
name.
Also, we thought of Athena as a lady of moderation. This is at the height, or if you prefer, the depth of the Vietnam War.
Ah, that's
and
right.
She represented to us moderation and a respect for other peoples and just a different view of life. And then we bought a dinghy for her. We called her Owl, because Athena had an owl, of course. And the thing about a schooner also is that this antique rig, broken up with many, many different sails, it's a delight to sail, because you have to know what you're doing to make that complex rig work. But it's great on the other end of the spectrum, because everything is very low tension, because it's broken into manageable units. And also, kids can hoist a staysail, certainly, or lay under one of the halyards in one of the big sails. And there's plenty of coiling rope to do and stay out of trouble or get into trouble. And we very soon found her put to work and over time taking kids to sea, because we felt that that was what we were there to do. We were there to re-implant and revive We were determined to do this somehow. We weren't completely sure how to do it, but we were going to do it. And that's why people started joining us. You know, a fellow walked in the door after we finally rented a fish stall, and this fellow walks in, walking with a cane, quite old, a little bent over, and he said, I understand you want volunteers here. And we said, oh God, we sure do. What can you do? He said, well, I've had a little experience in some of this. I was in charge of the restoration of the Cutty Sark, the world's last clipper ship in Greenwich. And that is the real story of South Street. The people who are out there who are longing for a center for this kind of activity and this whole way of life that goes with lofty dreams and hard performance in a tough environment, where there are no excuses and no excuses environment. And so Athena started as the first ship that belonged to the museum, really.
The picture on the screen there has the usual suspects aboard. That was when we opened the museum, and we were going to open it from the sea with floating ships. There's the Volare. I've forgotten the name of the owner of the Volare in the foreground. And there we are bringing in Athena with in the bow you will see Robert Ferraro, who was just speaking to you, and myself, getting the line ashore. And we also had Archie Horka. Was Archie Horka?
Yes, he was.
And
he was the Cape Horn sailor.
And Oz Brett, who were real seamen. Archie Horka sailed in square rig as a commercial seaman. And Ozzie was another one. He didn't send it sail, though, I don't think. And let's see. Well, the next thing is, how did I get involved in this? Because Peter was the real sailor here. We took a trip to San Francisco, and we had some spare time. It was Peter's job sent him to San Francisco, and so I tagged along. We had some spare time, and we went down to the waterfront, and there, the first thing we saw was the Wapama, the big three-masted schooner that Carl Cordham, San Francisco Maritime Museum, had at the waterfront. And we were just delighted. We had gone down to the waterfront for dinner, and we went on the pier to see we saw these masts and went on the pier, and it was open to the public at 9 o'clock at night. And I thought, this is amazing. There's no museum in New York that's open at 9 o'clock at night. This is great. Something good is happening here. And the next morning, and when we went aboard, I was delighted because there was a young man in his dress, navy blues, and he was taking a long time reading all the captions on all the illustrations in the Wapama. And so were we. And I said, whoever's doing this is doing an excellent job of involving people in this ship. The next morning, we came down again, and we saw from across the waterfront, we saw the masts and yards of the Balclutha. And, well, we scurried over there as quickly as we could. And once again, we were just delighted with what we saw. And I thought to myself, when we were flying back, we got on the plane, we're coming back to New York, I thought to myself, I was jealous. Boy, was I jealous. I said, New York should have this. Why don't we have something like this? New York's the greatest city in the world. It should have a maritime museum. Well, it seemed a good idea at the time. that's how I got seriously involved in it.
Well, and we didn't know who had been responsible for this wonderful urban center. There was nothing like it, really, in the world. there was Mystic, and Mystic we knew well, but this was in the heart of the city. And not only the figurehead on the Valclutha had looked out over tempestuous seas, importing grain from San Francisco to Europe and England. And here she was, that figurehead you saw just a moment ago, was gazing into the heart of San Francisco. And I was up early one morning and came down and I found a woman, a young woman, wheeling her baby carriage under that figurehead's gaze. So I didn't want to seem to hit on her in any way, but I say, why do you come here? And she said, oh, I think this is a wonderful place to be. Just look at that ship and look at that wonderful figurehead. And that's got to generate the kind of atmosphere that's going to be very good for my daughter, Anna. And I was sold. that was easy. And then directly to there we are. That vessel just looking right at this busy, distracted city. It just, it took both of us. We really argued all, we argue a lot. going back to the city, the whole trip we were discussing, we've got to get a ship like that. Well, guess what happened? The fellow who had gotten that ship, a very opinionated, strong-minded, tough Cape Horn sailor. This Cape Horn keeps coming up in all our stories because that was the acid test for the sailing ship. It's the world's, the toughest corner of the ocean world. And a ship that's been around the Cape Horn as Cape Horner, and a man that's been around under sail is a Cape Horner. And this Cape Horner, Carl Cordham, Joan here got to know him quite well. I don't think she's the person that she said, no, it was her, something she was saying about another person on the board. But anyway, he went over from from just having gotten that ship from San Francisco to getting us the ship that we have now in South Street and that we're struggling, really. We in the National Maritime Historical Society, Norma and I are not connected with South Street anymore, except that we know a lot of people there and hang out now and then, do little volunteer work. But it was Carl who found her and in the Riachuela, and one of the reasons she lasted, she was dismasted in 1910 in the Cape Horn gale. I mean, that is, makes her very historic. There's a piece of history, if you want. And he, Carl, persuaded our board of trustees that we were going to get a ship. That's the first thing we're going to do. And then the second thing, and I often sort of thank God about this, somebody had the sense to say, I've got a second motion. I've forgotten who it was on the board. And we'd just taken this resolute thing. We were going to get this ship that Carl had sold us on. I've got to say about her that in the Riachuela, which is a kind of rum down, my kind of place, a real kind of grungy, but the river people, they didn't call her ponton barge. They called her El Gran Verano, I think means the great sailing ship. And when we told the harbor artist, fellow called King Kayla Martin, a wonderful man, that we were going to take the ship away and put her in New York. His armbrist stood up and clapped his hands. Said, good, she'll be saved. You know, around here they just let her go, and that'll be it. But anyway, but the second resolution was that we thank the volunteers. At this point, we had 1,000 active volunteers, and they were keeping. We had 3 people on staff, with a total of something like $7,500 in the bank, and no immediate prospects, but we had some stalwart people. And we had Kent Borwick, by the way, not really by the way, who organized our first reception, which got a lot of what we call civilized uptown people down to our grungy corner of the world. And we got some marvelous people. Like, we never expected that. We expected the old sailors, and we even expected the kids, because we had our own schooner. We could take them out. But educated, whatever you want to call it, the rest of New York, proved very susceptible. They were very susceptible. Because we knew one great advantage that recent management in South Street has never mastered. Being able to understand that you don't know anything and that you turn to people who are veterans and do know seafaring. So we were very lucky from a very early date to get the top seafaring authorities in the United States, like this guy.
We should show the next image, which is what sold the trustees on the whole thing.
Yes, and there is...
That's a classic photo, which was... It's a photo portrait of the ship when she was in service. Was it Carl that got us that photo? Did Carl get us the photo?
Yes, from the San Francisco Museum.
It was this photo that the trustees took one look at it, and you could see that they were being lured in. They were starting to think, this is not a bad idea.
There she is, ready for sea. She's got 3,000 tons of grain under hatches, and there's not a rope's end out of place on that ship. And that is part of the seafaring culture, which we came to understand. We were really trying to give a new grip on life.
Peter, how'd you get her from Argentina?
We did a lot of begging, and we got a fairly low cost, $75,000 tow from Argentina up to New York.
It was a Dutch
and
company,
this,
right?
This, that didn't happen until 1970. It took us 3 years of getting out a newsletter, which developed into a magazine, and holding. And Kent Borwick held educational sessions with fishmongers, old Cape Horners, and sort of talkative people like me, or anybody who was around who could again add something to the heritage of seafaring, which for such a tough thing and so hands-on and pretty difficult. It's not a plaything.
Not
just going to
thing.
See. But it's curiously vulnerable if people don't have ships to look at. And ships to go to sea in, and they don't have a center of attention and concentration or even a place to meet, the heritage vanishes. It goes, unless you come to a library like this. And to bring it to life, that second motion was to thank the volunteers, the 1,000 volunteers who had started an ongoing conversation, a conversation mm-hmm. of many voices. Mm-hmm. And it was the contradiction that we worried about was that the Robert Albion, Samuel Eliot Morison, these are top-ranked historians.
Alan Villiers.
Yeah, and George Bass, the founder of the Institute of Nautical Archaeology. They were not distressed at being thrown in with a lot of ignorant people like us and like most New Yorkers were at that time. They weren't in the culture. They rejoiced in it because that meant they had an audience. And that wouldn't have worked except that these people knew the subject, gave it an enormous life. And the accomplishment of those early years in which Joan, I've got to say, also did much to get us to organize our approach to things, and with her father Jack Kaplan, really gave thought to the intricacies of the sale of air rights over some of the land we wanted to get, and other things that simply brought enormous depth and practicality to the growth of the institution. It had to grow up to its job. And that one advantage we had was that we knew we didn't really know much about anything. We were just like the unwashed people. We were there to get the message. And that was a good thing.
I think we should point out that this image is years further on in the story, but it does show. Now this is Operation Sail, and many of the vessels there were just there for that occasion, but it does show the waiver tree next to. Let's see, on the other side of the pier is one of our schooners, and the waiver tree is next to the...
That's the Peking.
The Peking.
And then over across the pier is the Sir Winston Churchill, manned by an all-girl crew.
They're here.
Which took some doing.
And that strange stacked thing behind the Winston Churchill was a vessel that was brought in so that we could have events on the pier. So weddings, meetings, people would rent it for, and it helped monetarily with our finances. Trying to see what else we've got there. Oh, and then they were going to scrap that little ferry boat. And we thought, well, there used to be a ferry running between here and Brooklyn, and it would make a great school. One of our early and very, very active members,
Dick Rath,
Dick Rath, worked for Boating Magazine and was, a really fervent member of the museum. And he thought that it would make a lot of sense to get kids who had just finished the drug treatment program that was being used in New York to give them something, a hands-on thing to learn, and why not teach them how to rebuild marine engines and especially outboard motors, because there was a lack of those things, the people with those skills, in the local marinas. And it worked beautifully well. So that was another aspect of the Seaport Museum bringing people into the museum that would otherwise maybe never get there.
Absolutely.
And helping these kids was, you know, just a fantastic thing to do. It was great to watch them learn and grow. And they all had to go out on the schooner. What was the name of the schooner? The metal hulled schooner.
Pioneer. Yeah.
They all had to go out on the Pioneer and sail and learn how to set sail and handle the schooner.
Well, it's not only that. They this is a case of young people hungry for the cultural experience, don't laugh, of discipline, because the boat don't move if you don't haul on the line, and if you don't follow, I'm sorry, orders to do that. And the experiences aboard the Pioneer went through this. They became a prized asset on the market because they couldn't get people from Harvard or some other high-class place that understood orders, and why your mates, shipmates, would be the ones who really disciplined you. God damn it, you do your share, we're all going to end up with no supper here, you know. Believe me, we wrote a book about it, and Terry Walton sailed the Pioneer in when the fellow who owned her died, a very good man, in an industrial accident. And she said that, what was it, Terry, the beautiful things of life, Pioneer?
Beautiful necessity of life.
Yes, a beautiful necessity of life. Now we're getting very close to the seafaring culture I'm talking about. You know, it isn't discipline in some master-slave sense. It's something that comes out of a group who have learned, goddammit, to get along together because they've got to. That's it. And the thing is that they knew, and all this is very new to me. I have no idea how to deal with people or anything. But it worked, and it worked differently each time. Joe Madison, who was around today, thank God, was. Also wrote about some of that. We want him to write a whole book.
Peter, we have to move along because we have to do time. We have to look at time.
Yes.
We've got the people on the screen now.
Yes.
And let's see, we mentioned Carl Cordham. He's the fellow standing in the middle who was, Carl was driven by he had a passion for saving sailing ships. And he not only helped us, he helped many others with working for the Maritime Heritage. Carl is in the middle. He came coming to visit. And that's Prince Philip on the right. And he was coming to New York, if I'm not mistaken, right, Peter? And
we sent a
telegram.
Norma and I had most of our stories begin with Norma and me, because it's just individuals, but we're the individuals that we know about. But there are other people of which we've done complete biographies that are in the book. The only biography of Carl Cordham is in the book. Because it is this business of individuals who don't lose their individuality, they use it, and it's part of what they're contributing to the whole. And anyway, we knew that Philip was coming in, and I had met him once or twice because of another organization. And A Silly Fellow's written a book which is competitive with our book, so I shouldn't say bad things about it. But he he recorded that meeting in a flippant way. Oh, they managed to get royalty involved. You crazy fool, excuse me. We had an argument with Philip, Philip said, and with considerable authority. He's not a fly-by-night. He was head of the National Maritime Museum and also of the Cutty Sark restoration that I mentioned earlier on. And he said, well, you chaps should he said, what are those great logs doing on there? They had a bunch of Pacific Coast pine stacked up on the deck. And so he explained that these are for the wooden spars that are going to go up and make that full rig we saw a moment ago. And he said, well, that's all very well, but you know, you can get the same effect with dura aluminium. I'm not quite clear how the English pronounce that, but
that's aluminium.
It's a form of aluminum that stands up to salt water. And I thought, oh God, here we go, because we believe, which I've decided I'd better tell Philip and everybody. oh, he said, you're just storing up
trouble.
A bunch of trouble for future generations. And I said, but sir, that is what we're here to do. We are here to stir up trouble for future generations. So they'll learn something. They'll learn fundamental things, that you have to deal with obdurate lumber and disagreeable people and all kinds of things. And the fellow writing this other book, which of course has many good things about it, I'm not going to mention. he just escaped him, completely escaped him, the idea. There was another thing that,
Peter, we better get on with the other people.
But the main thing is that this culture, I believe, and a great many people believe, and people I respect deeply believe, it has been embodied and performed in South Street. And it has, as Mike Seymour, who was the fellow who first did, the person who first introduced in the Municipal Arts Society a bill for a maritime museum in South Street, which became the Seaport. he said to me a few years ago, what bad luck we've had in the leadership of the museum. The membership declined from 25,000 to under 2,000. I know I went to do some volunteer work, and so I got to see the real numbers. And the scholars that had given us our glory, because it really was a great run. They migrated over to places like the National Maritime Historical Society, where we are today.
And Peter,
Peter, who's that guy on the screen?
Yeah.
That is Jakob Isbrandsen. He is the chairman, was the chairman. He and I were fired in the spring of 1976 because I'm afraid rather inadequate people who'd taken control of the board, conspiring, it must be said, with officials in the city government who felt that they didn't like our amateur ways and our insistence on several times I've brought in ships and they would order me not to bring them in the South
Skipper,
Street.
We have to move on faster than this.
They said they said they've got to go to the west side, then they can see Charm Square. But Chip people want to see ships. They want to be part of this maritime culture thing. So I had to go through this ridiculous act of calling up the press and saying, I will take the first line when the Eagle, Boeing federal government, comes in. I will take that line, so you can put me in jail. And of course, they wouldn't do it. And then when the Libertad, a beautiful, great ship, where they were named, came in, and that we had gotten to know those people very well because they'd worked on the waiver tree there. That's where we found the waiver tree. Well, I got a marvelous telegram from the captain, a fellow called
Peter.
At 7:30, yes. I'm. Yes. I understood that we had until 7:30.
You want to save time for question and answer, don't you?
Oh yes, my God, yes. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So this.
Sorry. That's the most important thing. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to say Vastes Majesty. Sent me a...
No. We're going to talk about Jakob and Joan.
When we were
getting...
Jakob.
I'm taking the...
Jakob.
We need questions. We
had to have some money to get started. And it was Jakob and Joan who gave us enough money that Peter and I could both at the same time quit our respective jobs and throw everything into all our efforts into going down and renting that little shop at 16 Fulton Street and getting the whole thing going.
Right, and then
for those two people, there would be no music.
Mm-hmm.
And this is Joe Cantalupo. He was the owner of the Cantalupo Carding Company. If you are old enough, you remember those big green trucks with the marvelous gold scrolls doing the not the general public, but the commercial pickup around the city of the restaurants, etc. And he walked through the door one day and said, he just told us that he'd been waiting for us. What took you so long? I'm hoping somebody would do this. And without people like that,
and he donated all of the garbage removal services. That was the key thing.
And he said, other museums are for people. This museum is people.
Yeah.
And everybody in the museum understood that and acted that way, acted accordingly.
And this picture is of Peter speaking to the crowd. You'll see Carl Cordham there with just to the right of there's Peter. To the right of Peter is Hal Hulberg, who was the commissioner of ports and terminals. Was it? Ports
and became Marine Aviation.
Became Marine and Aviation. And Carl's just to the right of him. And here we are. That was the crowd that was... That crowd there, which filled the streets, it was pretty good crowd, eventually became 25,000 head, but that was how it started. The next is this ex-Siemens Institute. Now here, people flocked to us. This group was one of the people who flocked to us. They just loved singing sea shanties. And they would come down on a regular basis, and when people knew that the ex-Siemens Institute was gonna be singing, they would come and they would bring their friends and, again, more members. The youngsters sitting on the pole were some of our young teenage volunteers. Now, these chaps over here, that's Burl Ives with a bunch of school kids, again, on the Letty G. Howard, which at that point I think we were still calling Caviar. And back to this shot, because... It's
That's the future.
It should be the future. And there's talk now of getting rid of ships, and some of them have already gone, but there were never too many ships at South Street.
Now, in opening a discussion to the group, I wanted to pass out these sheets in the gospel according to A. Louise Huxtable. She says there, I'll be very brief. As everybody here knows, the museum now has excellent leadership in a sea captain, John Bulwer, who was making bricks without straw practically, and the museum has an impossible lease that they've been forced to accept from the city, and we've got to ask that the lease be brought back to somewhere near where we started, with four piers and three blocks of land in a 99-year lease. We now have an argument about having three quarters of one pier, no 99-year lease, and the blocks of land are so confused now that I, for one, don't understand it. So we really need some people, and we're imploring everybody who is interested in this subject to weigh in one way or another.
Yeah, let's let them ask their questions.
Yes, go ahead.
How does the restoration of all those little buildings and the shops and all that, was that part of the museum? And did that generate revenue? And particularly the wonderful row houses that were left.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it's,
yes. 1820s houses, they have some surviving shops. They're the only survival of the museum shops. And because it had, they had a wealthy patron and a wonderful one that ran bound printing, commercial establishment. So it's a printing shop. And we just lost a wood carver who had a one-man shop who died just a few days ago. He'll be tremendously missed, but he left his smile behind him. He left his traditions, and that's the good stuff. The bad stuff is the dead Chinese bodies brought in as a shocking exhibit, and the I don't know the noisy some of the shoddiest stuff you found in suburbia. Not that suburbia is necessarily bad, but you don't come to the world's greatest city to get more of the same. And these things must change. And we have the borough president, president of the city council, a whole list of politicians and good ones. I've hobbled with them, I was going to say, walked with them, giving speeches and whatnot.
Let's see if there are any other questions, too.
Yeah, please. Kent, you were going to say something, I'd hoped anyway, about how you swam into this.
I was just going to say something about how this miracle of creating, bringing the ships in, bringing people to the waterfront. There was no one on the waterfront before Peter and Norma and Bob and Terry and other people started doing these things. Nobody, there was no place you could get to the water here. And then people started to come here. And then there was the miracle of bringing the ships, and the city stumbled late but did save Skirmerhorn Row, the principal buildings there from being destroyed. And it was interesting, it was almost lost then. There was a deal made to demolish two very well-connected New York, forget my back, real estate people, Atlas and McGrath. McGrath, being a former corporation council, bought one of Skirmerhorn Row. And smart money said that they would win. Developers always won. This is way back in the, beginning of the Lindsay administration. Nobody ever heard of a time when the developer didn't win a battle like this, particularly a developer as well connected as John McGrath and Saul Atlas. And by now, citizens have started to come together, and a group of people, Joan was one of them, sort of wrote an ad for the New York Times. And that ad ran challenging this and saying that this had to be saved. And lo and behold, it did. The Board of Estimate voted that ancient form, now ancient form of government, which wasn't so bad, each county was represented. And not just because of A. Louise Huxtable in the New York Times, but because citizens in Staten Island, Queens, and Brooklyn had gone to their borough president and said, this is important to us too. And I wanted, in the guise of asking a question, to say this, because the Seaport is now astoundingly, despite all its successes and all it's done for young people in New York and all it's done to be the really the first instance of reconnecting New York with its waterfront, is threatened all over again. And as usual, the villain is not the terrible developers, but it's been the city of New York from the very beginning that never clearly grasped what this could be and what it would take to do it. And even when it was all happening, the city insisted, all happening, that as the blocks were saved, the air rights were being transferred, the city insisted at that time, this will never work unless we get a big developer. And we got Rouse to come in. And Rouse was the best of the big developers probably in America to do the big festival marketplace thing. And that failed. And then after Rouse failed, another company called General Growth failed. And astonishing, why would it fail? Because New Yorkers don't need a place to shop. They certainly don't need chain stores to shop in. But notwithstanding those two major failures, the city is now committed to an unproven Texas developer called Howard Hughes, and to not just to take over the Seaport, but to build right here. My shadow will be standing, I'm not tall enough, right here to build a 60 or 70 story tower in the middle of the Seaport. And the city of New York so far, and it's an incredible thing. In addition to exploiting the historic district, the city, when this was named an historic district years ago, left out their own property. This property was right there. It's where the so-called New Market building is. And that's where their city is proposing to create a tower. And the city and the developer are pushing the Seaport Museum, which has no trustees. The city controls who's on the board. This has three trustees, all of whom are city employees. So this young captain, who's doing a valiant job trying to save the ships, the Goldberg that Peter mentioned, he's negotiating all alone. He has no, there are no Jacobus Bransons or Joan Davidsons on his board to try to be a force for them. So it's a terrible moment, and it will only be saved, it seems to me, that if once again, citizens of 79th Street, citizens of Brooklyn, citizens of Staten Island get organized to say, listen, it's crazy to let this great place disappear. And that's why it was wonderful that Peter and Norma did this book. This is a very enjoyable book, not just for people who love the sea, because you learn in this book how the city works, but it's a fascinating tale. But it's happily, this book has just come out now, at a time when it's never been needed more. So I hope people will go home tonight, be sleepless, and then think about writing Bill de Blasio notes saying, listen, let's save this place. It can more than work. Question earlier, but can it earn some income? Of course it can. But the, anyway, was there a question in there?
Yeah, I got a question. Did the Seaport ever make money, Peter?
Yes, it did. and it hauled it in by the bucketful once we'd signed those 99-year leases. All that is audited, and it's all a record. And we keep hearing, no, but it's always lost money. It lost money when the city, with some proxies involved, including some people that were put on the board and, in effect, took control.
The proof is in the back of the book. There are appendices in the back of the book, and some of the appendices show the audited reports from the seaport showing that it was doing well.
And it made money in the sense that it did, it performed, and people gave money and sponsored things. That mm-hmm. was the whole secret. And when you saw Prince Philip there, as a noticeable person, that was the National Maritime Historical Society, because the management, I'm afraid, at that time, without going into names and all tiresome stuff, was not equal to the task. And when we sent a frivolous telegram to Philip, he showed up, and that brought in a number of people who, you know, signed checks, and the checks were good.
Remind us of how many members there are.
25,000.
That's larger than the membership at that time of any museum in the city.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
At that time, it certainly was. I don't know what the Met now has. It was even more than Mystic did. Mystic was 11,000. The Met was about 10,000. Then.
Thank you so much. There are some handouts on the table immediately outside the door. The unit books for sale.